We'll start up here with the chart of the kings. We're going to be studying from 2 Kings 13 and 14 and 2 Chronicles 25 and 26. So if you would please open your Bibles to that. 2 Kings 13 and 14 and 2 Chronicles 25 and 26. In our studies of history and geography of the Bible, we've been looking at the maps and looking at the Scriptures and putting the places on the map where the events of Scripture take place. And we want to see the significance of those things in our study and rehearse in our minds the blessings of God upon those who do right and how that God cursed those who did wrong. Now, God had promised them that, and there are a list of passages that I've asked you to commit to memory regarding those things that God has said. We know that when Moses brought the children of Israel up out of the land of Egypt, he told them very pointedly, before they ever entered into the promised land, that if you disobey God and you start serving other idols, then you'll be destroyed out of this good land. Now, he told them that in Deuteronomy chapter 4, way back when, generations before they began to worship idols and depart from God's way. When Moses continued during the period of the wilderness wandering with those people, he told them two or three more times that if you serve idols, God will destroy you. And then Joshua, when he brought them into the promised land and had conquered the land, he too told them that God has done everything that he promised you that he would do. But if you worship and serve idols, he will also destroy you, just like he said that he would. Now, it just makes you scratch your head and wonder, why in the world did those people not understand what God said? For after the death of Joshua, when we come to Judges chapter 2, in verse 10, now we have a new generation on the scene that knew not God nor the mighty works that he had wrought in Israel. What's the problem? What's happened? Not being taught. And I don't know, brethren, if we can overemphasize the necessity of teaching. Yes. Well, that is true. Some are taught and they just won't accept it. They just don't believe it. And if we're not taught, then we don't stand a chance. But if we are taught, at least we have the advantage of knowing. But we find that with Israel, evidently they let a generation pass that were not properly taught. And so consequently, another generation on the scene knew not God, nor the mighty works that he had wrought in Israel. And I, for the benefit of those of you in particular in the class this morning that are younger, especially those who are visiting with us this morning, college age, I want to drive this point home. One of these days, you're going to get married. That's just likely inevitable. And one of these days, you're going to have little ones. And that's when you need to begin to teach them, just right out of the chute nearly, the things of God. Poor analogy. But you need to teach them the things of God and help them to understand what God has said from the beginning, on a daily basis, so they'll know and grow up knowing at least what God said. Now, one of the things that we have noticed in this series of studies, when God sometimes spoke directly to kings, it wasn't then that they didn't know. God had communicated directly with them. Can you think of an illustration where God spoke directly to a king a number of times, and that king wound up worshiping idols? Solomon. Classic illustration was Solomon. Saul, too. Yes. Can you think of another? Jehu, too. God spoke directly to these men and told them, here's what I want you to do. Here's what will happen if you don't. And they disobeyed God. How do you explain that? It wasn't as if they didn't know. They had been taught. They knew. They understood. But then they turned away. And that's as old as the beginning. You remember back in the Garden of Eden when Satan first tempted Eve? He tempted her with a question. What was it? All right. Has God said that you can eat of just all of these trees? And when Eve responded, she said, God said that there's a tree in the midst of the garden of which we may not eat or even touch it, lest ye die. Now, question, did she understand with soberness the thing that God said? Oh, yeah, she's got that down right. But then you'll note that when Eve saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that it was desired to make one wise, she took of it, she did eat, and she gave unto her husband with her, and he did eat. Did she know what God said? But she just blatantly disobeyed what God said. Yes. Well, that's right. That's right. And why do we want to? This is true. But you know, the irony to all of us is that we even began a negotiation with the devil. Why was she talking to him to start with? Yes, 1 Timothy 2. Yes, but before time, she just knew there was a tree in the midst of the garden she was not to partake of, and she was not to touch it, lest she die. And now, she's looking at it. She's seeing what benefits she thinks that it might offer. And that all as a result of what Satan has proposed. This is true. This is true. Joey, Randy, and then the Kings. Yeah, when you look at the other, and when you look at the other side of that coin, you've got the people of Israel that God had communicated with through the same plagues. And as soon as they got across the Red Sea on the other side in the wilderness, what did they do? All right, Randy? Yeah, you'd think you could do that, wouldn't you? You would think you could comply with that. Well, let's look back over at our kings. The kings of Judah and Israel. Now, this is part two on your lesson sheet. As you'll notice in your book, beginning actually on page 106. Now, we've talked about Athaliah. We've talked about Jehu. We've talked about Joash. And I want to line these up for you on the chart. This chart you're going to see many times as we pursue our study of the line of the kings. Now, we note over here that with the exception of Athaliah, who was the daughter of Ahab, that's right, we follow a lineage of kings from King David. That's right. God had said, I will establish your house. Now, when we look at the kings of Israel, we see that there are a number of dynasties in Israel, and by that we simply mean that no one family had his throne established throughout that lineage. Often, if someone determined that he wanted to be king, What did he do to the kings that were before him, or the king that was before him? Just kill him, and then you get to be king. Now, was that not what Jehu did? Jehu became the instrument of God to pronounce judgment on Jehoram and Azariah, or Ahaziah, who was king in Judah, Jehoram king in Israel. And, of course, it was also Jehu that killed Ahab's old wicked wife, Jezebel. But we see then that because Jehu was an instrument in God's hand, God said, I'm going to establish your kingdom for how long? Four generations. Well, what's that say is going to happen at the fifth generation? Going to end, and we're going to have a new dynasty serving as king. And so, for the purposes of our study, we're going to use this chart, and our arrow is just going to come down the page as we examine these various kings. But I want to talk with you this morning a little bit about Jehoahaz. Now, Jehoahaz, king of Israel. Good king or bad king? Bad king. Now, every time I ask you about a king in Israel, you're going to say, bad king, because they didn't have any good kings. They were all bad. Beginning from Jeroboam all the way through, they were all bad. Notice, if you would please, that though God had spoken unto Jehu, how did Jehu wind up? He was not good. And his son, Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, was not a good king. He was a bad king. Welcome to our class. We're studying of the kings of Israel. And, of course, this is the text that we're going to be reading in just a moment as we talk about the king, Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, king in Israel. Now, as you'll turn to the text of the Kings, 1st or 2nd Kings, chapter 13, 2nd Kings, chapter 13, let's begin at verse 1. It says, in the 23rd year of Joash, the son of Ahaziah, king of Judah, Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, began to reign over Israel in Samaria and reigned 17 years. And he did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah, and followed the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, wherewith he made Israel to sin. He departed not therefrom. Now, question, why is Jeroboam mentioned? What did Jeroboam do? And who was he? All right, exactly right. And that's what we learn here that Jehoahaz is doing. He's continuing the practice now of calf worship. It says in verse 3 that the anger of Jehovah was kindled against Israel, and he delivered them into the hand of Hazael, king of Syria, and into the hand of Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael, continually. Now, some translations that you may be reading from indicates all the days, or all their days. The point being is that Israel just had a constant, ongoing irritation, opposition with the kings of Syria. But in verse 4, it picks up again, and Jehoahaz besought Jehovah, and Jehovah hearkened unto him, for he saw the oppression of Israel, how that the king of Syria oppressed them. And Jehovah gave Israel a Savior, so they went out from under the hand of the Syrians, and the children of Israel dwelt in their tents as before time. I want to stop right there. When we talk about Jeroboam, and he's in trouble. He's in trouble with the Syrians. And what does he do? We know in the previous verses that he worshipped the golden calves of Jeroboam. But when he's in trouble, who does he turn to? I believe we described that Wednesday night as the spare tire, a tire effect. You know, we don't need God. We don't need to know who He is or recognize Him as any importance until we get in trouble. And that's what this king did. And the irony of that is God had compassion upon Israel. and promised to send unto them a Savior. We're going to look at verse 6 where it says, "Nevertheless, they departed not from the sins of the house of Jeroboam, wherewith he made Israel to sin, but walked therein, and there remained the Asherah also in Samaria." What are they doing? They're continuing to worship idols while their king has besought God on their behalf. And what does God do? And why does He do it? He's promised to send to them a Savior. But if you'll drop down in that text and pick up the reading at verse 22. Verse 22. It says, "And Hazael, king of Syria, oppressed Israel all the days of Jehoahaz, but Jehovah was gracious unto them, and had compassion on them, and had respect unto them, because of His covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and would not destroy them, neither cast He them from His presence as yet. And Hazael, king of Syria, died, and Ben-Hadad, his son, reigned in his stead." Now, I want to pause just there and let's talk about that. Jehoahaz has besought God, while at the same time he's been worshiping calves. Now beseeching God, God decides He's going to spare Israel. In fact, I'm impressed that the text says He had compassion on them. Why? All right. But why Israel? We know that that promised seed was to come through the lineage of David. Why not just zap Israel and be done with it? Eventually, but yet we see it's not the time. Joey? All right, please note that we're not far away from the time when the hammer falls. In 2 Kings chapter 17, we begin to read about that, how that God raised up the Assyrians, and the Assyrians took Israel down, took them captive, but not yet. Time is not yet, the text tells us, for God to do that. Now, I want you to notice what I've tried to circle. We did this Wednesday night. How that he worshipped Jeroboam's golden calves, but when he was in trouble, he besought the Lord for help. Now, here is a map that demonstrates for us, I think, the approach of the Syrians as they came into Israel. And we're going to talk about that some more as we pursue our study. But as we look at these kings, I want to go back one step here and read for you, or with you, verse 25 of chapter 13. 2 Kings chapter 13, verse 25. It says, "And Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, took again out of the hand of Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael, the cities which he had taken out of the hand of Jehoahaz, his father, by war. Three times did Joash smite him, and recovered the cities of Israel." Now that's going to be real important to us, because the way this is stated to us in 2 Kings chapter 13, we have what sometimes we refer to as meanwhile back at the ranch kind of a setting. Here we see what Jehoahaz has done, and we see in this last verse what Jehoash does, but we have to go back to see the beginning of Jehoash's reign and some of the things that he does. And so we want to go back in the text, but again, I want to come down the line of the kings. We've talked about the king Jehoahaz, and here his son is Joash. Now, or Jehoash. Now, I want to call your attention to the fact that sometimes in the reading, this is stated just like this. Joash, Jehoash. But you see on our chart of the line of the kings, they're not the same person. That's interesting. That's interesting. Yes, very good. Carolyn and then Richard. Ah, yeah.
And I'm confused because you have on the right side, you know, go back to stupid words.
Okay.
Okay, Jehoash.
I'm there.
That's on the Israel side there.
Yeah.
Is that the same as Joash? I thought he was Judah.
Okay, we do have a Joash, and he is referred to as Jehoash. Oh, here reversed?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Amaziah. Well, let's go back to the text and see if we can find it. Yeah.
Okay, so now on the right hand side, where your little arrow is, Jehoash.
He's the son of Jehoahaz, king of Israel. That's correct. You want me to put the one up that's really confusing? Yes, I've noticed that more than once. There are verses that use both of the names in the same verse to identify the same character, but two names. Same verse, yes. Very good. This is one incident where you see that, and you see it also, just to add to the confusion, back up to verse 10. Verse 10, chapter 13, 2 Kings chapter 13. In verse 10, it says, in the 37th year of Joash, king of Judah, began Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, to reign over Israel in Samaria. So, notice carefully. This man was reigning in Judah when this man became king in Israel. And as Richard has pointed out, this man, Jehoash, in Israel, is also called Joash. Of course it is. Yes. So let's not get overly confused, but that's just the normal amount of confused, yes. We don't have so much of that, of course, as we continue on down from this point. But as we talk about Jehoash, we see that he was a very wicked king. Let's go back and pick up the reading at verse 10. And Randy, if you don't mind, would you please read for me, beginning in verse 10 through verse 13. Chapter 13, 10 through 13.
2 Kings 13, 10 through 13. The 37th year of Joash, king of Judah, Jehoash, son of Jehoahaz, became king over Israel and Samaria, and reigned 16 years. He did evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not turn away from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who which he made Israel sin, but he walked in it. Now the rest of the acts of Joash and all that he did and his might with which he fought against Amaziah, king of Judah, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? So Joash slept with his fathers, and Jeroboam sat on his throne, and Joash was buried in Samaria with the kings of Israel.
All right, here we see where Jehoash becomes king, and again, just to throw something out that I know will likely be confusing to you, back up to verse 9 and compare that with verse 10, and you see that Jehoahaz slept with his father, and they buried him in Samaria, and who became king? Joash. Now, in verse 10, what's he called? Jehoash. Yeah. So, we have to be careful in our reading so that we don't get overly confused, just the normal amount. Yes. 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 Very good. Now, during this time when Jehoash is king in Israel, we find that Elisha is the prophet. Now, in verse 14, Elisha becomes sick. It says, of his sickness whereof he died. And Joash, the king of Israel. What else is he called? Jehoash. That's right. He came down to him and wept over him and said, my father, the chariots of Israel and the horsemen thereof. That's a rather significant statement. Jehoash refers to Elisha with the same expression with which Elisha had referred to Elijah back over in 2 Kings chapter 2 and in verse 12. What is it that both Elisha and Joash understand about the prophet of God? Who is he? Well, look again at this expression. My father, the chariots of Israel and the horsemen thereof. What were these prophets to the people of God? Both Elijah and Elisha. Well, do you have an army without horses and chariots? What were these prophets? Why are these terms used to refer to these prophets? What were they to the people? Warriors, I'll accept that, that's fine. Good to see you. Warriors, as it were, leaders of the people of God. Now, Elisha recognized that about Elijah, and it would seem that Jehoash, or Joash, the king of Israel, has occasion to see that about Elisha. You're the prophet of God. You're the one that leads these people. Now, interestingly enough, by way of contrast, what about these kings who were idolaters? They were leading the people in the wrong direction. But these prophets were servants of God. Look further, if you will, in the text. In verse 15, chapter 13, it says, and Elisha said unto him, take bow and arrows, and he took unto him bow and arrows, and he said unto the king of Israel, put thy hand upon the bow, and he put his hand upon it, and Elisha laid his hands upon the king's hands, and he said, open the window eastward, and he opened it, and Elisha said, shoot, and he shot. And he said, Jehovah's arrow of victory, even the arrow of victory over Syria. For thou shalt smite the Syrians in Aphek till thou have consumed them. And he said, take the servants, and he took them. Take the arrows, and he took them. And he said unto the king of Israel, smite upon the ground. And he smote thrice and stayed. And the man of God was wroth with him and said, thou shouldest have smitten 5 or 6 times. Then hadst thou smitten Syria until thou hast consumed them. Whereas now thou shalt smite Syria but thrice. What's the prophet of God trying to tell the king in this analogy? Well, yeah, but he's prophesying to him these battles of victory. Yeah. But he didn't do that. Now, the rest of the text becomes there in verse 22 through verse 25 becomes an explanation of this. We see that he defeated Ben-Hadad three times. In the text, he regained cities that had been taken by Hazael. So we see that there was some good accomplished. But what about the Syrians? Do they just go away? Oh, they're not gone. They're not gone. Now, it's interesting to me, at least, in some of the reading of the text and studying of this portion of Old Testament history, and we've noted this a number of times, how that in a context where we see a series of events that relate to one particular king, or perhaps two kings, we see something that just kind of becomes a parenthesis in the narrative, like what we see here that becomes noteworthy. If you'll notice in verse 20, it says that Elisha died, and they buried him. Now the bands of the Moabites invaded the land at the coming in of the year, and it came to pass, as they were burying a man, that behold, they spied a band, and they cast the man into the sepulcher of Elisha. And as soon as the man touched the bones of Elisha, he revived and stood up on his feet. Does that get your attention? Elisha died, and he's buried. They put him in a sepulcher. Now, what is a sepulcher? A tomb, hole in the ground, might be in the side or it might be down. Above ground, okay. Above ground. But what'd they do with this Syrian? Well, I've got that wrong on the board. It says the Moabites invaded the land. I was thinking Syria, but that should be one of the Moabites. But when they cast him into the tomb, what happened to him? He revived. Would that get your attention? What would that convince you about Elisha? Well, yeah, would you think that would get the Moabites' attention? Did it? Well, hold that thought, because we're going to revisit that. Let's look at our line of kings again. Kings in Judah, Athaliah, Joash, and so forth. Kings in Israel. We've talked about Jehu, Jehoahaz, Jehoash, Jeroboam, Zechariah, Shalom, Menahem, Pekahiah, and Pekah and Hoshea. We're going to talk about him because he's the last king in the northern 10 tribes, and he's the one who was conquered by the Assyrians. But let's talk just a little bit on the other side of the chart about Amaziah. Turning you, if you will, in the account of the Chronicles. Now, one of the things that we've noted between the Kings and the Chronicles, some give a more detailed account than the other. Some give us just a few details that the other does not. And so we want to look at this account, particularly in the Chronicles. 2 Chronicles chapter 25. 2 Chronicles chapter 25. In 2 Chronicles chapter 25, beginning at verse 1, it tells us that Amaziah was 25 years old when he began to reign. And he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Jehohanan of Jerusalem. And he did that which was right in the eyes of Jehovah, but not with a perfect heart. Flag goes up. What does that mean about Amaziah? He's got problems. Yeah, he's not going to remain faithful. In fact, if you drop down to verse 14... of this same text, verse 14, it says, "Now it came to pass, after that Amaziah was come from the slaughter of the Edomites, that he brought the gods of the children of Seir, and set them up to be his gods, and bowed down himself before them, and burned incense to them." Amaziah, good king at first, but what does he eventually do? He begins to worship the idols of the Edomites, and we see that there were severe consequences for that. Now pick up the reading, if you will, in chapter 25 at verse 4. It says, but he put not their children to death. I'm sorry, let me get verse 3. Now it came to pass, when the kingdom was established unto him, that he slew his servants and that had killed the king his father. But he put not their children to death, but did according to that which is written in the law in the book of Moses, as Jehovah commanded, saying, the father shall not die for the children, neither shall the children die for the fathers, but every man shall die for his own sin. Now, on the surface, that would indicate that he's a good fellow, because after all, the folks that assassinated his father, he's taking care of them. He's killing them, but consistent with the law, he's not going to kill their children. Now, the Old Testament text that's alluded to here is Deuteronomy chapter 24, beginning in verse 16. Now, that's not the only allusion in the Old Testament text to this thought. You remember in the prophecy of Ezekiel, in Ezekiel chapter 18, perhaps you're more familiar with it there, where the prophet said in verse 20 that the son doth not bear the iniquity of the father, and the father doth not bear the iniquity of the son, but the soul that sinneth, it shall die. Now that's the principle that's being observed here by Amaziah, the king in Judah. But let's look and see what he did in verse 5 beginning. It says, moreover, Amaziah gathered Judah together and ordered them according to their fathers' houses, under captains of thousands and captains of hundreds, even all Judah and Benjamin. And he numbered them from 20 years old and upward, and found them 300,000 chosen men, able to go forth to war, that could handle spear and shield. What's he doing? Draft. That's right. He's drafting the army. He's building his army. And what does he want to do with his army? Well, let's pick up the reading at verse 7. It says, but there came a man, I'm sorry, verse 6, it said he hired also 100,000 mighty men of valor out of Israel for 100,000, for 100 rather, talents of silver. We've talked about this a number of times. What was typical during this time that a king might do when he's anticipating going to war? Hire mercenaries. That's right. And that's what he does. Where does he get them? Isn't that interesting? I didn't think Israel and Judah got along so well. Money talks. Yes. Look at verse 7. But there came a man of God to him, saying, O king, let not the army of Israel go with thee, for Jehovah is not with Israel, to wit, that all are with all the children of Ephraim. If thou wilt go, do valiantly, be strong for the battle. God will cast thee down before the enemy, for God hath power to help and to cast down. But Amaziah said to the man of God, but what shall we do for the 100 talents which I have given to the army of Israel? And the man of God answered, Jehovah is able to give thee much more than this. We've talked about that a number of times. In fact, we talked about that with King Saul and how that King Saul's son, Jonathan, with his armor bearer, just the two of them, were willing to fight against the Philistines and began the victory of Israel over the Philistines. Noting that God does not deliver according to numbers. Now, the man of God tells this king, God does not deliver according to numbers, so those folks that you've hired as mercenaries from Israel, they're not going to be blessed. Don't take them with you. Now, what's the king's response to that? What about all this money we've already paid them? Yeah. What about all this money? 100 talents that I've already given them. And God said, that's not the issue. Verse 10, then Amaziah separated them, to wit the army that was come to him out of Ephraim, to go home again. Therefore their anger was greatly kindled against Judah, and they returned home in fierce anger. That's interesting to me, because now they've made their money and they didn't have to fight. Nobody has risked their lives, and they can go home free without an injury. Why are they angry? Honor. We wanted to fight. We were hired to fight. That's true. I'd forgotten that. That's right. Yes. In verse 11, and Amaziah took courage and led forth his people and went into the valley of Salt and smote the children of Seir 10,000. Now, the children of Seir, we don't commonly refer to them as the children of Seir, but who are they? The Edomites. That's right. And on our map, we've noted where they are, that the Edomites are just below, just south of Judah, just south of the Moabites. In fact, the Edomites are relatives of the Israelites. And we've talked about that in times gone by. But God is not intending for him to fight with these soldiers against the Edomites. And so that alliance is dismantled. Yes. They're descendants of Esau. That's correct. Yes. That's absolutely right. Yes. Yes. Now, these who anticipate fighting against the Edomites, arm in arm with the army of Uzziah, they're not only disappointed, they're not only angry, but what do they determine they're going to do? We're going to go back. Yeah. But who are we going to fight against? Isn't that interesting? It says in verse 12. And other 10,000 did the children of Israel of Judah carry away alive and brought them to the top of the rock and cast them down from the top of the rock so that they all were broken in pieces. But the men of the army whom Amaziah sent back, that they should not go with him to battle, fell upon the cities of Judah from Samaria even unto Beth-horon, and smote of them 3,000 and took much spoil. So this army of Ephraim, of the northern 10 tribes, as it were, the army of Ephraim, they come down and fight against Judah. And they kill a whole bunch of folks. Because this alliance was not honored. Now that's interesting to me. Any comment or question just here? Everybody's got a blank face. Totally confused. Okay? Well, let's hope not. Let's hope not. The next portion of this text, what was it that God had said to Amaziah? Don't take the Israelites with you. Why not? Because I'll be with you. I'll fight the battle. And so Amaziah goes and he's victorious in the battle, fighting against the Edomites. But when he's finished fighting against the Edomites, what does he foolishly do? All right, the Edomites served idols, so Amaziah brought back their idols. Now, that was not an uncommon practice for a conquering king to either destroy or bring back the idols of his enemy. But what Amaziah does is he bows down before them and begins to worship them, burning incense unto them. But wait a minute. Hadn't God already talked with him through the man of God and told him that I'll give you the victory? Hasn't that been proven? He's gone with a much smaller army and he's defeated the Edomites. But he brings back their gods and begins to worship them.
It's really hard for me to wrap my mind around the mindset of someone wanting to worship the idols.
Well, you know what, Joey? It was kind of difficult for the man of God, too. If you look back in verse 15 of this text, it says, wherefore the anger of Jehovah was kindled against Amaziah, and he sent unto him a prophet who said unto him, why hast thou sought after the gods of the people which have not delivered their own people out of thy hand? How do you explain that? Amaziah, these are the gods of the Edomites, but you conquered the Edomites. Those gods couldn't do a thing to save them. Why are you worshiping them?
Yeah, the true living God, that is,
Yes, have you ever in frustration raised the question to someone, what in the world are you doing? You know, we've raised that question a number of times in this study so far. We've talked about the deal that Jehoshaphat made with Ahab. What in the world are you doing? And then when you go into battle with the Philistines, Ahab wants to put on the attire of a regular soldier and dress Jehoshaphat in his royal attire when he's fighting against the Philistines. And Mr. Jehoshaphat, what are you thinking? Why would you do that? And then we talked about Jehoshaphat's son, who essentially did the same thing with his uncle over here, Jehoram. Well, why? What are you thinking? Why would you do that? You ever do something foolishly and beat yourself up and say, well, I don't know why I did that. It was a dummy thing to do. Well, what he's doing is a very dummy thing, but friend, listen. Sometimes we do some pretty dummy things and we realize later that it was a dummy thing to do, and somehow we become so deluded in our minds because we think now that it was a dummy thing to do that there are no consequences for being foolish. You ever do something foolish that the consequences just keep coming and biting and biting and biting and biting, and sometimes for the rest of your life you live with the consequences? Case in point, yeah, we will. David, thank you. David behaved very foolishly, but the consequences kept biting him the rest of his life. All right, thank you for your participation.